Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, brought to you in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. We've got a real treat for you today. I spoke with a fellow I've just met. His name is Jonathan Alger, and he's the brand new president of James Madison University. Now, that fact alone might get him a slot on this show. James Madison University, obviously reminiscent of James Madison himself, and of course, Montpelier and all that good stuff. But the real bonus here is that he's not just a university president. He's not just someone who's very interested in educational outreach and all the things that we're interested here at this show. He's a guy that has specific background in two of the most important affirmative action cases in the history of the Supreme Court, the Grutter and Gratz cases, which he oversaw when he was an assistant general counsel at the University of Michigan. I recently spoke to him about those cases and about affirmative action generally, and he went all the way back to the beginning.
The history in a lot of people's minds really starts with Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. Even though that's a case about the K-12 schools and integrating those schools, the importance of desegregation, it certainly had a major impact on higher education as well. And in fact, at about that time in the 1950s, there were other cases involving higher education that were quite similar to Brown versus Board of Education about this question of what does it mean to be separate but equal? Is that really equal? But Brown, of course, was the case where the Supreme Court finally did say, no, separate but equal really is not equal because inherently you're setting up a situation where people have different opportunities and therefore there's no substitute for actually integrating our institutions.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that it wasn't just K through 12 that was segregated. You alluded to some other higher education cases. Law schools were segregated. Exactly. Colleges were segregated. And if I recall my order of cases, my history correctly, the actual first couple of cases where desegregation was ordered were on a law school level. Wasn't there one out of Louisiana?
That's correct. Well, the big case that went to the Supreme Court in 1950 was actually out of Texas. Sweat versus Painter. And there's been a lot written about that case just recently. It's one that's been largely forgotten because of Brown versus Board of Education. But it's a fascinating story where civil rights organizations had been planning for a while a challenge to this practice. Texas, like many other states, essentially had segregated colleges and universities. The University of Texas Law School was only open to white students, not to African American students. What happened is that this student applied to the University of Texas for law school, and the response was to basically create a separate law school for this one student. And the question was, is that really equal access to legal education to have one student by themselves? You certainly don't have the same faculty, the same kind of library, the same kind of interaction with other students. And so in that case, just a few years before Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court looked at that situation and said, look, this is not an equal situation. This is a very different law school than the University of Texas Law School. And so they ruled against the university, but they didn't go quite as far as they did a few years later in Brown, where the Supreme Court said inherently the concept of separate but equal is one that we find not to be true and not to be consistent with equal protection. So they took a larger step, if you will, in Brown versus Board of Education, but the seeds were actually already sown for that decision a few years earlier in that case out of Texas. And so colleges across the country were watching Brown very carefully to see what the Supreme Court was going to do.
You mentioned equal protection, and we should pause here and say that's the constitutional clause that is most implicated in these cases. The 14th Amendment, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says that no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws. And we keep going back further and further in time, but I mean, that was passed, I believe, in 1867.
Right.
Or ratified in 1867. It was largely ignored throughout the 19th century. In fact, the infamous case of Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896 established that concept of separate but equal ensconced in the Constitution. And so it was that period from the late 19th century through the early 20th when we had so-called Jim Crow or the black codes that existed throughout much of the country, especially the South. And it was post-World War II was when the civil rights movement really took off and started dismantling those one by one. And so what you were describing is it really started in higher education and was overshadowed by Brown, but then Brown really changed everything.
Right.
Okay, so pick up the story from there, please.
So what happens after Brown versus Board of Education, people perhaps in some cases thought that overnight things would change, the schools would become integrated, but in fact that's not what happened. The story is much slower than that. We fast forward a decade later into the early 1960s. Most college campuses still were almost entirely segregated, with very few exceptions around the country. Many large universities, like the University of Michigan, had very, very few students who were African American or Hispanic, for example, on their campuses. And so in the early 1960s, you start to get some civil rights legislation, like Title VI of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, that urged colleges to go further. And then some executive orders that urged colleges to go further. So colleges started to take some affirmative steps to deal with this problem of segregation. And these steps are sometimes referred to as affirmative action or equal opportunity programs, where, for example, they considered race as one of many factors in their admissions policies in order to diversify their student bodies. Now, at the time, they thought that what they were doing was remedying discrimination. That was the starting point, and that was the theory that they were acting upon. And certainly there was a history of societal discrimination that was reflected at those college and university campuses. So that's it takes you through the 60s into the 1970s. In 1978, you have a case that gets to the Supreme Court, the Bakke case out of the University of California, where one of these policies was challenged. It was a medical school where they'd set aside a certain number of seats for students from certain underrepresented backgrounds. The Supreme Court said in that case in 1978, that you can't set aside seats for members of underrepresented groups. That's a quota, and they said that violates the Constitution.
If I recall correctly, they did in Bakke, it was almost as if they designed it for our ease of reference. There were exactly 100 seats in the incoming class. And exactly 20 of them were set aside for people that they considered to be underrepresented minorities. And so there literally were 20 seats where this fellow Bakke could not be considered. It was very rigid. It was a quota, as you say. Okay.
That's right. So, and Bakke was a white applicant to the medical school who was not admitted, and so he was challenging the fact that there were certain seats for which he was not eligible. The court, though, was quite divided in the Bakke case, and the view in the Supreme Court that became the critical vote, if you will, was Justice Powell, and he was the swing vote, the deciding vote in that case. And what he said is, well, we can't remedy societal discrimination at an individual institution, that you can only focus on remedying present effects of past discrimination at your own institution. So they really narrowed this remedial rationale under the Constitution. But Justice Powell also said there's another rationale here for the consideration of race as one of many factors in admissions, and that is the importance of diversifying the student body, that diversity has educational benefits for all students, majority and minority alike. And that was something that a number of schools had written about and talked about in the Supreme Court at that time. And so Justice Powell's swing vote in that case became essential, because colleges around the country looked at his reasoning and said, okay, we need to design programs that are based on the educational benefits, the educational value of diversity and having a diverse student body. And it's not just about race. Race is just one of many factors that we consider when we think about diversity. We also think about things like socioeconomic status and geographic diversity, students with special skills and talents, gender, students who come from very different cultural backgrounds and family backgrounds, who've overcome obstacles of different kinds. So that's what the court talked about in Justice Powell's opinion, and that's what colleges started to do, was to develop programs following Justice Powell's rationale.
Before you go on from there, and I want to elucidate this just a little bit, you said it was a very divided court. If I recall correctly, there wasn't actually even a majority opinion.
That's right.
And so when you keep talking about Justice Powell's opinion, that's by design. I mean, there was not a majority opinion. They got a majority decision. I think it was 5-4, but it was very close. But they didn't have a majority of justices who agreed on why they were doing what they were doing. Bakke wins, but nobody could really agree on what it was, or not that many people could agree.
Right. You're absolutely right, as you pointed out. Trying to count up the votes in the Supreme Court, there were lots of legal debates after 1978 about what was really controlling here. Was Justice Powell's opinion really the controlling opinion of the Supreme Court? And there were organizations that developed that decided they wanted to challenge Justice Powell's opinion, and that said, leading up to the Michigan cases, that they were looking for the Alamo for affirmative action, that they wanted to challenge this concept once and for all of any sort of consideration of race.
And the Alamo they constructed was in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
It was indeed. So these cases were actually deliberate challenges that were brought in. And again, it was not unique to Michigan. Colleges across the country had adopted similar programs. But Michigan was a highly selective public university. And the theory in challenging Michigan was, well, Michigan is very selective, so a lot of students don't get accepted at the University of Michigan. And it's public and supported by the taxpayers to some extent. And therefore, the thought was that if we can attack Michigan, we'll get more public support because people will be concerned about how their taxpayer dollars are being spent. So Michigan was a deliberate choice, if you will, by the plaintiffs. They actually tried to interview people that they thought would make good plaintiffs and be sympathetic figures in the media and brought these cases in federal court in the 1990s.
So this was deliberate advocacy. There were advocacy groups out there looking for plaintiffs and looking for a good case to bring. Right. And we can't leave that state university aspect without comment as well. Constitutionally speaking, you have to have state action. If you're going to bring a case pursuant to a constitutional issue like the Equal Protection Clause, it has to be a public university. Right. Now, the private universities might be governed by statutes, and that's a separate issue, but constitutionally, it's very important that these are state institutions.
Right.
Okay, so.
Yes, and to reiterate, though, you mentioned that there are federal statutes like Title VI, and the reason that's important is that those statutes essentially have the same rules applying to any private colleges and universities that get federal funds, including students with federal loans. The reason that's important is that when Michigan was challenged and when these cases went to the Supreme Court, Harvard and Stanford and Yale and all of those private institutions across the country were going to be affected in the same way that the University of Michigan was going to be affected. So while the constitutional question was specific to public universities, under parallel statutes, the private universities were going to be affected as well. And that became an important piece of the puzzle, because when you looked at what types of programs might be effective for these different schools to diversify, you had to take into account this very broad impact that these cases were about to have.
Huge impact. So the storm clouds were gathering over you in Ann Arbor, and you took this. Was there ever a point when you regretted your decision to be the university's point man on these cases?
No, not at all. It was a wonderful experience, because we all, as a team, really felt that we were reflecting the educational mission of the university and the university's educational values. That was the focus of the argument from our perspective. In some ways, it would have been easier to settle cases like this out of court. It might have been less time-consuming and less expensive, but the reality was it was a matter of principle that we strongly felt in terms of the educational mission of the university, that having a diverse student body because of its educational benefits for all students was really an important thing. And I saw that firsthand as someone who had done a lot of teaching as well. I taught at the University of Michigan, law school students and students in the School of Education, for example. And I saw firsthand those educational benefits in the classroom as I had more diverse classes where students, for example, African-American students would disagree and debate with each other about issues like affirmative action, or white students would disagree and debate with each other. And it really brought home the point that if you have a critical mass of students from these different groups, that you could see differences within groups and similarities across racial lines. That's how you break down stereotypes and where real learning can take place. And so I witnessed it firsthand in the classroom, so I knew that the principle we were fighting for made sense from an educational perspective.
You used a term there, and I have to ask, did you invent that term? Did you invent the term critical mass?
Well, it was certainly something that developed in these cases.
I'm just going to give a little foreshadowing here. That's going to be an extremely important term post-Grutter. You're being very modest here. I'm suspecting maybe you came up with that, didn't you?
Well, it was certainly something that the team talked about. It existed in the literature, but it became really important in the Michigan cases in the Supreme Court.
Let's talk about the cases themselves now, if I may, because we've been speaking sort of in abstractions.
Right.
Who were these plaintiffs? Who was Gratz? Who was Grutter? Where do they fit in? What exactly were their claims and arguments?
Right. So there's two separate cases, first of all, that were brought simultaneously. One was a challenge to the undergraduate admissions policy. That's the Gratz case. The Grutter case is a challenge to the law school admissions policies. So very separate, two different schools within this large university. Both of them are white women who don't get admitted to the University of Michigan through the regular admissions process. And the complaints that both of them bring say that we believe we were not admitted because the University of Michigan was considering race as one of many factors in its admissions process and that other students were getting in ahead of us. So that was the centerpiece of their claims.
The significance of them being white is obvious,
yes.
But is there any significance to them having both been women?
Well, we know that the folks that were bringing these cases were trying to find sympathetic plaintiffs, people who would be good in the media, and I think the fact that they were women perhaps played off of the fact that in many ways women also had not always had equal opportunity in higher education. So that may certainly have been a factor, although I can't say for sure because that was decisions made by the other side.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering also if maybe their focus was exclusively on race as a factor in affirmative action. Maybe they would have wanted to remove the gender issue by picking women. I don't know, I'm just speculating.
Right.
But okay, so you've got two women, one who applied to the undergraduate college.
Right.
That was Gratz, right?
Yes, Jennifer Gratz.
Jennifer Gratz, or Gratz, as you say. And I've always had difficulty pronouncing these. Up until recently, I was pronouncing it Grutter. But,
right, and it is Grutter is the way we always learned it. Barbara Grutter, who was the applicant at the law school.
If there are two ways to pronounce something, I will always choose the incorrect one. But Gratz and Grutter, and so there were two women, one at the undergraduate level and one at the law school, both been rejected, and both claim that they would have been admitted but for this racial preference that each of these institutions engaged in, that they alleged.
Right.
Okay.
Now, one important difference, though, so there are two, as I said, two very different cases. In the case of Jennifer Gratz, she's talking about an undergraduate admissions policy, which is a point system where you could get points for a lot of different factors, your grades in high school, your standardized test scores, but also a lot of other things, your leadership, if you were a scholarship athlete, for example, special skills and talents, letters of recommendation, being socioeconomically disadvantaged, and race was one of those many factors. But the predominant criteria were actually the academic criteria, the grades and the test scores. But it was a point system, so it was very quantitative in nature. The law school policy is what's been referred to as an individualized, holistic review process. No particular points given to any factor, but you have people reviewing applications that look at them in their totality and make educational judgments about who should get accepted into the class, taking into account all the different types of factors that they think make a good entering class. So it's not just grades and test scores, but again, factors like geographic diversity and people who are interested in different areas of the law that want to study in different ways and do different things with their legal careers. So there are a lot of factors that were considered in that individualized holistic review.
It's your weekly constitutional. We're talking affirmative action with the president. No, not that president, another president, Jonathan R. Alger, the president of James Madison University, who in his previous life was intimately involved in two of the most important affirmative action cases in the history of the United States Supreme Court. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with President Jonathan R. Alger of JMU. Stay tuned.
Now the world don't move to the beat of just one drum. What might be right for you may not be right for some. A man is born, he's a man of means. Then along come two. They got nothing but the genes, but they got different strokes it takes. Different strokes it takes. Different strokes to move the world. Everybody's got a special kind of story. Everybody find
Okay, time again for the constitutional quiz. Kelly Carmichael, what do you have for us this week from the We the People curriculum?
Well, I have a question that gets at some of the principles of our Constitution, our constitutional system.
A principled question. All right.
Principled question.
What's your question?
Which of the following is not a fundamental principle of the American constitutional system?
Which of the following is not a fundamental principle of the American constitutional system? Okay.
Sure. And the answer choices for you are the following. A, executive supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
B, popular sovereignty.
Hmm.
C, rule of law. Or D, checks and balances.
Which of them is not? So we're looking for three that are. Well, let's go in reverse order again. So let's look for things that are part of our basic constitutional value system. What's answer choice D again?
Sure. Answer choice D was checks and balances.
Yeah. Checks and balances are all throughout the Constitution. In fact, it goes, you know, we call it in law school the separation of powers doctrine, and it comes from the very arrangement of the Constitution dividing the federal government into three branches. And giving each of them powers that overlap and conflict with each other. So, no, that's definitely part of our system. So I think we can eliminate D as an answer choice.
That is correct, and something that James Madison believed strongly in as well.
Oh, yeah, that was his whole plan. That goes all the way back to the Virginia plan. All righty.
All right, C was rule of law.
C was rule of law. Well, now that doesn't appear anywhere in the Constitution, but, you know, that underlies everything that we do in the Constitution.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, the concept is that in any society where people are going to get along with each other, they all have to agree to abide by the same rules. The high and the low, the low and the mighty all must abide by the same rules. And typically, that the concept of rule of law is expanded to the idea of an independent judiciary which interprets those laws equally and that treats everyone equally when they have conflicts. So,
and that nobody, not even the president or a member of Congress, is above the law.
Exactly. And so that's very fundamental in our system of government. The very idea of having a constitution emanates from the idea of the rule of law. So I would say we'll have to eliminate that too, because that is part of our constitutional theory.
Very important principle, yes. And B, popular sovereignty.
Oh, well, popular sovereignty, I mean, that's where all power comes from, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, at least if you're not a dictatorship or a monarchy or one of the other many forms of government that the people suffer under, if you believe in representative democracy, then ultimately power comes from the people. So I think we can also eliminate choice B, and that leaves us with A.
A, executive supremacy.
Right.
Something that we really don't like.
We don't like it at all.
We fought very hard to make sure that would not be the case.
Indeed we did. And the interesting thing is that though on the one hand we can kind of laugh about it and say, nah, we don't want a king, there are still people today who are so into executive power that they come awfully close to thinking that executive supremacy is something we should have as one of our constitutional values. So that's one of those very, very troubling ideas that sticks around a little bit more maybe than some of us would like. But I think that we can say that's the one, that's the outlier, that's the one that's clearly problematic. So I think the correct choice is answer choice A, isn't it?
That is true. It is not a fundamental principle of the American constitutional system.
And let's hope it remains that way.
Fortunately, based on rule of law and the way our Constitution is written, I think we're safe for the time being.
Let's hope so.
For a very long time.
Okay. Until next time, then. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
You've been a strong supporter of affirmative action.
Yes.
And you're a constitutional law professor. You and your wife went to Harvard Law School.
Mm-hmm.
Got plenty of money. You're running for president.
Mm-hmm.
Why should your daughters, when they go to college, mm-hmm. get affirmative action?
Well, first of all, I think that my daughters should probably be treated by any admissions officer as folks who are pretty advantaged. I think that we should take into account white kids who have been disadvantaged and have grown up in poverty and shown themselves to have what it takes to succeed. So I don't think those concepts are mutually exclusive.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're talking today with Jonathan R. Alger, the president of James Madison University, all about two of the most important affirmative action cases in Supreme Court history, Grutter and Gratz, from the University of Michigan.
It turned out I'm from Michigan, so yes. I'm very familiar with both of these fine institutions.
And so I've always told my students when I've been teaching these cases that it seemed to me that the rationale for using such two very different systems is probably easily explainable simply in terms of numbers.
Right.
They're both very selective institutions, but the undergraduate college is a large state university, and they have literally, I'm guessing, tens of thousands of applications every year. So it simply makes sense that you would have a relatively mechanistic, a point system so that you could simply filter down to a reasonable number of applications that would get seriously considered by a limited admission staff, whereas the law school probably had applications that were maybe in the low thousands.
Right.
And it's much more imaginable that you could read every single file in a holistic fashion. Now, is that a reasonable speculation as to why the two differences existed?
Well, that is certainly part of the puzzle, and the Supreme Court talked about the fact later that you can't just design programs that are based on administrative convenience, if you will. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that the undergraduate process, you're absolutely right, there were 25,000 plus applications a year at the time, and certainly even more so now at the undergraduate level at the University of Michigan. So they had to come up with a system that would treat people fairly. Now, the reality is that all of those applications, including letters of recommendation and essays, were actually read by people working in the admissions office at the University of Michigan. But what they were concerned about was, with so many people reviewing applications, how do you ensure some consistency across all of those different reviewers and what they were doing? So the idea of the point system was actually to try to be fair and consistent when you had so many people who were reviewing all of those applications. Whereas at the law school, the dean of the law school actually had ultimate discretion about who would or would not get admitted. And it was much easier to do that with a more manageable number of applications.
Okay. Well, that puts a different spin on it. Okay, so the point system was not merely for administrative convenience, but at least as far as the University of Michigan was concerned, it was a way to improve fairness and to improve consistency.
Right.
All right, okay, it's important to understand that. Okay, so you've got these two systems, they're both being challenged.
Right.
What does the court say about them?
Okay. Well, they sort of work their way up through the lower courts, and mm-hmm. both of them end up at the Supreme Court at the same time. One of the interesting features of this litigation is that while the law school case was ripe for Supreme Court review, if you will, the undergraduate case hadn't gotten quite as far yet in the lower courts. But the Supreme Court did something very unusual. They said, look, these are related cases, and we are going to consider them both at the same time. The university actually could have tried to oppose that, but at the end of the day, we realized, look, once you're in the Supreme Court, that's the law of the land. We're going to have to follow their guidance anyway. And it was a strategic advantage to have two cases simultaneously in front of the Supreme Court with very different models, because we knew that we could change the mechanics of a particular admissions policy, and the two worked in very different ways, as we've already described. But they both dealt with this fundamental question of whether diversity has educational benefits that would justify some consideration of race as a factor. So the diversity question was central in both cases. It gave the Supreme Court the opportunity, if you will, to split the baby, to exercise that kind of wisdom of Solomon, and that's exactly what Justice O'Connor and the Supreme Court did.
Let's pause here. You said strategic advantage, and that's so cool when you start talking about strategizing for the Supreme Court. Effectively, you were giving them two very different systems and acknowledging that maybe they would strike one down.
Right.
And hoping that if they were able to strike one, that they might be better disposed toward the other.
Right.
That it would present a good contrast.
Right.
So you knew that going in, that they might pick one and not the other.
Right. We absolutely knew that was a risk, but we also knew that the big prize here was the question about diversity and whether that was a justification for these sorts of policies. If we lost on that question, then none of these programs, no matter how they're structured, would have been possible. So that was the fundamental question. We felt that the mechanics was very much a secondary question, because you can change the mechanics of a system once you have guidance, and that's exactly what ended up happening.
That's so important. You mentioned that diversity now, which had been mentioned in Bakke, has come to the fore, and let's explore for a moment why that is. Right. Remediation has always been questionable. To what extent can you remediate past discrimination at all, and especially once you get past your own institution? And an additional concern has arisen over the years, is remediation appropriate any longer? I mean, as we move further and further away from the era of Jim Crow, I mean, have we passed the time? Is the time over? Should we go back to a more even-handed application of equal protection? So if you have an alternate justification for affirmative action that is diversity, then you've got something very important.
Yes, and I like to look at it in some ways as the remedial rationale sort of looking backward at the past, whereas mm-hmm. the diversity argument is looking forward at what kind of education are we trying to provide for our students to prepare them for the world that they're going to enter after they graduate. And it's all about benefits to the entire student body. It's not pitting one group against another. Remember, the theory at the University of Michigan was that all of our students are benefiting from having this diverse student body. The white students are benefiting, the Hispanic students are benefiting, the African American students are benefiting, because they can all see those differences within groups, that not all individuals think alike or act alike just because they have the same race, and that there are similarities, that you may have things in common with people across racial lines. You're only going to come to that realization if you have that face-to-face interaction with students of different backgrounds and provide that opportunity very directly for them to interact both in and outside the classroom.
And if you have enough diversity.
Exactly.
As you said, a critical mass. You don't right. just want to have a token student from this group right. and one from that, right. and everyone, you can put them in the student bulletin and you know, right. put them on the posters. Right. No, you want to have enough of them so that there's really a difference in the classroom.
Right. And that's, I'm glad you phrased it that way about in the classroom, because the theory of critical mass is not a precise number. It is not a numerical concept. It's really an educational concept. What we were talking about is having enough students from all of these different backgrounds so that you wouldn't just have token representation, one African American student or one Hispanic or Latino student in a very large class where people would look to them somehow almost to be the spokesperson for their race. But you're also not talking about racial balancing either, just trying to mimic the population of the state or the country.
But it's funny you should mention that. I remember an old episode of The Cosby Show. You remember mm-hmm. that from
oh,
the
yes.
80s? And Mrs. Cosby, she was a lawyer. He was a doctor, she was a lawyer. And she was invited onto a talk show, a television talk show. And all these white guys would sit there and talk about important issues and ignore her. She kept trying to get in the conversation and ignore her. And as soon as it was a racial issue, then they turned to her and say, oh, right. well, what do you think about that,
right.
Mrs. Huxtable? And she got really irritated with them. She said, you know, I have opinions on these other matters as well.
Right.
I'm not merely the oracle of race relations.
Exactly.
And so that was what you're trying to avoid.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly right. So the idea of critical mass is to have enough students so that they feel empowered in that background to be able to express themselves freely and to have very different points of view from one another. So it's an educational concept, and it relies on looking at how and where students have those opportunities to interact in large classrooms, in smaller seminars, in dormitories, and dining halls, and all those different places across the campus. But it's not a precise number. It's an educational concept.
Okay, so diversity is now front and center. It's your frontline argument. It's your big chance. It's your big day. Did the court buy it?
They did indeed. Justice O'Connor reaffirmed the principles that Justice Powell had talked about in the Bakke case, but this time around it was very clear that a majority of the Supreme Court agreed with her, and she said that, yes, diversity is a compelling interest in higher education because of these educational benefits for all students, and she really emphasized the fact that all students benefited. She also said that we as a court owe some deference to educational judgment, which is really important, leaving aside any questions about diversity. This idea that educational institutions need to be able to make academic judgments about how to put together an entering class, what types of criteria you're going to consider in the admissions process. Justice O'Connor said that at the end of the day, those are fundamentally educational judgments, and we owe some deference to those frontline educators who are making those decisions. For example, at the University of Michigan Law School, the faculty had weighed in and had helped to develop their admissions policy based on their own experience of what they had seen in the classroom.
Very interesting. So it's looking, well, let's get to the specifics then. They bought the diversity argument. How did they actually decide the cases then?
Right. Well, they upheld the law school model. So they said that individualized, holistic review is what we consider the right way to go, because you're treating everybody as an individual. It's not mechanical. It's not automatic. But that everybody has an opportunity to demonstrate what they would bring to the table as part of an entering class. So it's flexible, and everybody has that opportunity. opportunity. They struck down the undergraduate model insofar as it had that point system that we talked about earlier, because they said when you assign a specific number of points to a factor like race, that's too rigid and mechanical, and it doesn't provide that individualized look at each person. And so what that did then is it gave clear guidance to colleges and universities across the country on how to design their programs if they were interested in pursuing the educational benefits of diversity.
Justice Powell lives.
Yes.
He was vindicated that day. Okay, so his approach, which would have said to Bakke or to anybody else, is that you're going to get a fair shake, and we might consider your race, we're going to consider everything else, but we're not going to allow any system where, even arguably, you might just be excluded and not be fully considered, considering everything in your application.
Right.
And very, very interesting. And in a way, it was really just an affirmation of Bakke.
It really was. And this had been guidance that colleges have been following for many years. And so it was, collectively, the colleges across the country breathed a sigh of relief that the programs that they had designed based on Bakke and Justice Powell's opinion still met the requirements of the law. Now, the court gave a lot of other details on the second part of the decision, which is what we call narrow tailoring, where they said if you're going to have these types of programs, they have to follow certain types of requirements. For example, you have to show that there aren't race-neutral alternatives to achieve the diversity that you're seeking. You have to show that the programs have flexibility. You have to examine them periodically over time. You can't just set them in stone. And Justice O'Connor was particularly concerned.
Before we get to that, because that's important, and I want to get to that. I think I know where you're heading. We've actually come, I believe, to your personal involvement, because now you've had this great vindication of all these policies of all these colleges ever since 1978 in Bakke.
Right.
And I believe that that's where you came in. Was you rounded up a lot of those other colleges and universities, didn't you?
I did. One of my roles at the University of Michigan was to lead the amicus brief, or friend of the court effort, where you get briefs in front of the court, not just from the parties themselves, but from other voices that say to the court, here's what the impact of this case is going to be on us. So we actually had a record-breaking amicus brief effort in the Supreme Court, and it wasn't just the usual suspects. We had colleges and universities from across the country. We had civil rights organizations. Those were probably to be expected. But we also had major Fortune 500 companies who weighed in and said that diversity was important to them, and they relied on the colleges to provide a diverse and educated workforce. We had military leaders who had been retired from the U.S. military that talked about the importance of diversity in the U.S. military, particularly in the officer ranks. Those were voices that really got the attention of the U.S.
I was really struck by that. I remember seeing that and noting that the Army and the other military services had done that, and I was particularly struck by that because that's how I paid for my college. I was an ROTC cadet.
Great.
And it was true. I mean, the Army was a far more integrated, far more diverse institution, even when I joined it back in the 1980s, than most other institutions with which I'd been associated, institutions of higher learning. And I could, as soon as I heard that the Army had weighed in on the side of the University of Michigan, I said, ah, now that makes sense. They want to keep the pipeline full.
Right.
They want to continue doing what they've been doing, and if there's no more affirmative action, they figure they're going to have trouble finding officer cadets, officer candidates.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to Jonathan Alger, the president of James Madison University, all about the constitutionality of affirmative action. And he should know, because he's been intimately involved with two of the most important affirmative action cases in Supreme Court history. After the break, we'll talk a little bit about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with President Jonathan Alger of JMU. Don't touch that dial.
If you can see you through mine instead of your ego, I do believe you'd be surprised to see that you've been blind. Hey, walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Hey, for you, you criticize and accuse.
Well, Kelly, tis the season, isn't it?
Tis the season.
I'm feeling jolly. So what's happening this week at Montpelier?
The December 7th through the 9th, we will be having our annual candlelight evening at James Madison's Montpelier.
Well, that sounds intriguing. What happens then?
So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evening, starting at 5 p.m., you can come and do a really lovely house tour. Mm-hmm. And as visitors leave the visitor center and walk on the trail to the house, the trail will be lit by lanterns that will guide your path to the mansion, where you can come in to meet James and Dolly Madison. A lot of decorations of
that particular seasonal decoration
from the Madison era. So this will be a really fun time to come enjoy the holiday season.
Oh, I bet it will be. In fact, it'll be dark by 5 o'clock, and it will be a very romantic setting. I think this would be a lovely thing for young couples in love or old married couples, I'm not going to say me and my wife, because then I'd be calling her old. But, you know, even us some more settled people would probably enjoy such an evening, wouldn't we?
We have been known to have a proposal happen.
Have you had proposals at Montpelier? Well,
yes.
Of course you would, now that I think
gorgeous,
of it. It's
yes.
a great setting. So if you want to marry your sweetie pie...
You
this
want to propose.
Is the time to do it.
So Dolly Madison has been known to assist in the actual proposal itself.
That sounds extremely cool. So when is this again?
December 7th through the 9th.
We're going to rename this. We're going to call it Proposal Weekend. All right. Thanks very much, Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Jonathan R. Alger, the president of James Madison University, all about affirmative action, his involvement with it, and perhaps what will happen this term in the United States Supreme Court.
I want to emphasize that filing an amicus brief in the Supreme Court is a huge deal.
Yes.
Normally speaking, a party, the petitioner or the appellant, will file the initial brief. And that's a huge, it's actually bound. It's a bound volume of a certain color. Is it red or
green?
Green, okay. And just the preparation of that can cost tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, okay? Then there is the respondent's brief, right, similarly involved, and all the rest of that. And that, what color is that?
Well, actually, you're correct. It was red for the other side. Ours were green.
Yours were green, and then red for the respondent,
yes.
And then, or however.
Right.
And then if there's a reply to that response, then that's yet another color.
Right.
So these are very, very expensive, very, very elaborate. I mean, if you work on a brief for the Supreme Court, it's like giving birth. It's publishing a book.
Yes.
So to convince another entity to go out and make that kind of effort,
right,
means you had to convince them to spend tens of thousands of dollars at the least to prepare something like
right.
this. So this was no easy task.
That's right. No, it was actually wonderful to see the outpouring of support from across the country. There were a lot of people who stepped up, including a lot of lawyers, who said, we will write these briefs pro bono. We won't ask to be paid because we believe this principle is so important in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And so we helped them to get in touch with some of the organizations that needed or wanted to file briefs but didn't necessarily have their own lawyers. But people came out of the woodwork wanting to be supportive, including educational researchers who talked about the research evidence in support of diversity and why it's important in higher education. They were some of the real heroes as well, because they put their work out there, and it was subject to a lot of public criticism at times, but they said, this is important, we've studied this, and we believe it's really important.
Do you think it made a difference, all of those amicus briefs?
It absolutely made a difference. In fact, you can see it when you read Justice O'Connor's opinion in the law school case. She talked right at the outset about this broad societal consensus that diversity was important, and it's important at every level of society. She talked about the pathway to leadership and the importance of having that be visible and open to people of all backgrounds. So not just higher education, but our K-12 schools, and then what happens after higher education. Having opportunities in corporations, having opportunities in government, having opportunities for leadership in the military. She cited these amicus briefs in her opinion. So we knew that it had made a significant difference, and they talked about them quite a bit in the oral argument as well.
Well, you mentioned oral argument. You've made this enormous contribution to the case. Did you get to make part of the argument yourself?
I didn't get to do the oral argument.
Oh, man, they didn't let you get up there.
It would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Although I certainly spent hundreds of hours with the preparations. The way that usually works in the U.S. Supreme Court, especially now, is there are people who are specialists that argue Supreme Court cases. And we knew that we had one shot at this, and so we had two very prominent lawyers who argued for us. Maureen Mahoney, who was a well-known Republican, a Rehnquist clerk, who argued the law school case, and then John Payton, a very prominent African-American civil rights advocate, who argued the undergraduate case. So they made together a tremendous team. Both of them had experience in front of the court, and the justices knew them. And so that, I think, made a difference as well. We had that immediate credibility in the Supreme Court. But as a team, we spent many, many hours preparing and rehearsing for every possible question. And we felt very pleased at the end of the day because we had anticipated the central questions that came up in the argument.
So no surprises.
No big surprises.
Well, that's a sign of good preparation,
yes.
Then. Did you actually go and watch the arguments?
I did, yes. Yeah. I was right up front, and it was a tremendous experience. If people haven't been to the Supreme Court before, it's not a very big room, actually. It only holds a few hundred people. It's a very intimate atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So you're not far away from the justices. And sometimes that can be a little uncomfortable when the argument gets heated. But it was a great experience. And that particular day was unlike most days in the Supreme Court. You had a lot of very prominent leaders, political leaders who were in the courtroom that day, civil rights leaders and leaders from the world of education. In fact, the marshals of the court, I could hear whispering before the argument started, saying, it's going to be a little harder to control this crowd than usual, because many of them knew each other,
it was
quite almost a festive atmosphere. But you had a sense immediately of the importance of the event when you saw who was in the room that day.
Did you have trouble restraining yourself when you wanted to jump up and answer a question?
I did. There were many times, I think, when I and others wanted to speak up, but we had rehearsed well, and I thought that Maureen and John both did a wonderful and very capable job, so the preparation definitely paid off. The time goes very quickly.
Oh, sure.
And you realize that you really don't get all of your points across, so you hope that they also pay a lot of attention to the written briefs, because that at least gives you the full opportunity to make your argument.
Very, very interesting. Well, I interrupted you a moment ago. You were going to say that toward the end of her opinion, Justice O'Connor also brought up another very important point, and would you continue with that?
Well, one of the things that we knew Justice O'Connor was very concerned about was having these programs be open-ended, because times and circumstances change. And I think it was very important to her to know, what's the end point? How do we know when it's no longer necessary to have these types of programs in place? And she asked that question in oral argument. Well, it's very hard to put a specific deadline on it because times do change and it's hard to predict the future. But there are certain indicators that you can look for when you know within your applicant pool that you're getting students of all different backgrounds that are equally prepared, when the K-12 schools essentially are giving you that full pipeline of students. But in her opinion, it was very clear she felt she needed to say something concrete about this issue of timeliness. And so she said, well, we as a court hope and expect that 25 years from now, race will no longer have to be a factor, that these programs won't be necessary anymore in admissions.
Well, that's I have to stop you there. That's extraordinary, John. That's the only Supreme Court case that I'm personally aware of where they put a fuse on it.
Yes.
Where they said, this is constitutional today, but it very well may not be constitutional a quarter century from now.
Right.
I mean, that's extraordinary because we're almost halfway through that period now.
Right.
We're about, 9 years out now?
Yes. And what was interesting about it, it was a generational view. And this is an issue that had been debated back in Bakken before as well in the Supreme Court about how long might these programs need to last. Thurgood Marshall was having these debates with Justice Powell back in the Bakken case. What Justice O'Connor said was, she said, well, it's been a generation, about 25 years from the Bakke case in 1978 until 2003 when we get here to the Michigan cases. And incidentally, it had been a similar period of time from Brown versus Board of Education to Bakke, 24 years, a previous generation. So the thought was, well, in another generation, we hope and expect to be at the place where this is no longer necessary. Now, having said that, it was not what we would consider a holding of the court or a binding decision, but it did send a clear signal. Now, I took that signal as meaning if we're serious about that, there's a lot of work to be done. In order to get to that point, that means that our schools, not just colleges and universities, But our K-12 schools as well need to be doing a lot of work to provide that equal opportunity and equal access to get to that point. So the other side, of course, said it's a short fuse, a short leash, there's not much time. But I and many others took it as a call to action to say there's a lot of work to be done here. And Justice O'Connor herself, later on, I have heard say, I'm not sure that we got that right, that I felt we had to say something about the amount of time that it might take. But she herself could see that the K-12 schools had a lot of struggles and a lot of challenges to overcome, and she has been very concerned about that.
I sometimes wonder whether Justice O'Connor regrets having retired from the court,
yes,
because she's still very active, of course. She still, yes, hears cases by designation at the Circuit Courts of Appeal. And things have changed since 2003, haven't they?
They have. Of course, Justice O'Connor is no longer on the court. We have a different composition now of the Supreme Court. They now have a current case pending in front of them that challenges some of the premises of the Michigan decisions, a case out of the University of Texas, the Fisher case. Mm-hmm. And it's a different court, and Justice O'Connor's voice is no longer there as the swing vote. And so there's a lot of concern about what this court might do with these same issues. Here we are only 9 years later, and they're revisiting these landmark decisions once
again. In fact, she was replaced, if I recall, by one of the most conservative justices, Justice Samuel Alito. And then, of course, in the meantime, the Chief Justice, Rehnquist, who was a fairly conservative fellow, has been replaced by John Roberts, who may be even more conservative in some respects. At least he's been rather outspoken in a couple of cases in the last few years about affirmative action. And I think his most compelling quote was, I think I'm paraphrasing here, but the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race.
Right.
And that's a fairly clear indicator of how he feels about affirmative action.
Right.
Are you concerned that the court has taken the Fisher case just in order to reverse Grutter?
Well, I think most of us that are watching the Fisher case carefully hope and expect that the Supreme Court won't overturn the fundamental point about diversity as a compelling interest, that diversity has educational benefits. That was such a central point that, again, had been in question dating back to 1978. Colleges and universities had developed their programs in good faith based on that guidance, and it takes years to fully implement these programs and to see their results. We're only 9 years out from those 2003 decisions. And the court historically has also talked a lot about the importance of precedent and not overturning precedents easily.
Well, they talk a lot about that, but this court has
this court has been a little different, as you say.
Yeah.
And that is a concern.
Yeah.
But my own hope and expectation is that they will not overturn that fundamental question. Where I think the action will be in the Fisher case is on the narrow tailoring piece of the decision from the Michigan cases. That is to focus on how these programs are structured and the details, for example, of how do you show that it's necessary to consider race as a factor? Have you firmly established that there are not race-neutral alternatives that might be effective? I think that's where a lot of the questions are going to be. The definition of critical mass, as we talked about earlier, and how do you demonstrate when
and by the way, we skimmed over that.
Yes.
The court specifically used that phrase.
They
said, and I think it was part of their discussion of deference that was given to educators, was, you know, educators tell us they need a critical mass of these students. And so that was a very important phrase, and that's the first time I remember seeing it in Supreme Court opinions.
Right.
Now, what are the facts of Fisher? I mean, are they identical to Grutter, or is there a significant difference here that's going to allow them to take a different tack, as you say?
Yeah, now Fisher is in some ways a quite different case. So Abigail Fisher, again, is a white applicant who is denied admission to the University of Texas at the undergraduate level. She ended up, by the way, going to LSU, so it's not as if she wasn't able to go to college and get a good degree. But in any event, University of Texas had something called a percent plan in place, where the top 10% of the graduating students in Texas public high schools are guaranteed admission to the University of Texas system. Now, the reason that plan was developed in the first place was because of a case called Hopwood a few years earlier. In that case, a federal circuit court, the level just below the Supreme Court, said, you know what, we're looking at Bakke and we don't think Justice Powell got it right, and we don't think that was really a majority view of the Supreme Court. We don't think diversity is a compelling interest. So they struck right.
What year was Hopwood?
That was 1997.
Okay, but hadn't Hopwood effectively then been overruled by Grutter?
Well, and that's exactly what happens. Mm-hmm. So Texas put in place a percent plan after the Hopwood case because they needed something to try to diversify their student body, and they were not able to do what was happening at a lot of other schools like Michigan. Once the Michigan cases are decided, the state of Texas says, well, wait a minute, now we know that, in fact, diversity is...
I have to clarify again. Just Hopwood was in which circuit?
The Fifth Circuit.
Fifth Circuit. And let's just clarify then. Because Hopwood was in the Fifth Circuit, it really only governed a geographic area that's mostly in the South.
That's correct.
Okay, including Texas.
Right.
So the University of Texas system was operating from 96 forward under a different rule than up in the Sixth Circuit where Michigan is.
That's correct.
Okay, that's why Michigan could do its race-conscious program, but UT, University of Texas, was not doing it.
Right.
Okay, and that was pre-Grutter. Grutter changes Hopwood.
That's correct.
But the University of Texas's program's already in place,
yes,
and apparently they've stuck with it.
Right.
Okay.
So Texas thought, look, this percentage plan has had some success. We have achieved some diversity in our student body. Now, the reason that happened, by the way, is because the schools in Texas were highly segregated. So you had some school districts that were almost entirely white, others that were almost entirely African-American, and still others in the state of Texas that were almost entirely Latino or Hispanic. So if you think about taking the top 10% of all those school districts, you're naturally going to get some diversity because of that segregation in the public schools. And that was one of the concerns, by the way, about this plan in the first place, is does it encourage or does it perpetuate segregation in the public schools by relying on that to achieve diversity? Nevertheless, so they felt that they had achieved some success with that program, but it hadn't achieved all of their goals. And they looked at what was happening in other states like Michigan, and they said, you know, if we're able to consider race as something of a factor, in addition to a lot of other factors, then we can achieve our diversity goals. Texas, remember, at this time is going through a period where the demographics are changing rapidly. There are many, many more students of color coming up through the pipeline. And so if they were achieving numbers that looked like their admissions back in the 1990s, that really wasn't doing all that well because of the fact that their demographics were changing and it was becoming really a majority-minority state, if you will. So Texas, after Michigan, says, we're going to keep our percent plan in place, but we're going to add onto it, we're going to layer onto it some consideration of race and other diversity factors as well, because we need that in order to achieve the full diversity that we're seeking. So that's what was being challenged in the Fisher case, was this reintroduction of race as one of the many factors. Now, if you think about it, part of what was happening, most of the University of Texas students were coming in through this percent plan. What that meant is they were taking a very narrow definition of merit and putting together an entering class based on your class rank. It's not looking at students who play different musical instruments or students who have other skills and talents or who've overcome obstacles of different kinds. It's a very narrow way of choosing an entering class. Remember, we talked earlier about the importance of educators having some ability to think about what an entering class should look like in its totality. That's what the University of Texas said is, look, the percent plan has certainly done some good things for us, but by itself, it's a narrow tool, and we need broader tools in order to achieve the full diversity that we're seeking.
And that's the part of it that's being challenged now. And
yes.
So, as you say, it's possible the court could just look at that part of the Texas program and say, guys, you just went too far. That's not narrowly tailored enough. There are race-neutral alternatives here, and indeed, your percent plan is a race-neutral alternative, and that's good enough. They could do that, and you're thinking that's what they might do, is strike down just that part of the Texas program?
That is, I think, my hope and expectation at this point is that it would be a narrow ruling. Now, obviously, I would love for them not to touch the Michigan cases just 9 years later, but I think the reality is we know we have a different court. Justice Kagan, by the way, is recused in this case, and the reason for that is that she had actually helped file a brief for the U.S. government
right.
in her previous role as
Solicitor
before being,
General.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So you're down to 8 justices. Justice Kennedy is now widely seen as the swing vote. And while in theory he's talked about the fact that some of these programs might meet constitutional muster, he's never actually found one that where he was able to embrace the details.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to John Alger, the president of James Madison University, for sharing with us his knowledge about the Grutter and Gratz cases and about affirmative action generally. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.